Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
Where did you guys meet? This is cool. This is a very Avengers style moment.
I think it was when they were doing that Evolution of Addiction conference.
In LA.
I went out for a few years, like around 2013, 2014.
I really love that. And that's where Alan and I got our start. And, and so I'm very grateful for it.
So Jamie, are you over your jet lag?
I'm never over my jet lag.
It took me a while. It sucks going back and forth from the States to the UK. It was even worse. The Recovery Reimagined, the first year, to London. I think most of that time I was just like, a golem. I was just like doubled over just because I was so tired.
Well, interestingly, I was in Australia the whole month of July. So
I hear that's the worst, actually.
I've had, I don't know. Sometimes I find Europe worse because, at least from the East Coast, because with the 6-hour time difference, you arrive in the morning and that's when my sleep gets messed up. Whereas some other places in the world, Australia is a long trip.
You ever thought about doing a podcast of your own? Or because I know you do speaking. No. Okay.
She seems certain about that.
I attempted one that was more yoga based back in 2018 with a friend. And I've thought about podcasting, but my schedule is so all over the place. It's just never felt like something I have felt called to do. However, I will be a guest on anybody's podcast anytime. Morning, Alan. Good to see you, friend.
Good to see you. And welcome to the podcast, right? There is, as Patrick calls it, the pod.
The pod.
Yeah.
I already feel like I'm sitting in some good meeting energy right now.
That's what it feels like to us. We've discovered a long time ago that this is definitely one of our meetings.
You know, Jamie, you've just been such a great voice for so many things in recovery, but especially about the woman's experience in recovery and around trauma and its impact on people and the steps. And obviously what this focus on is our focus is on emotional sobriety. So, and I know that, we got to spend time together in Dublin, which was wonderful. I mean, what a great event that was. And it was a powerful thing. So, why don't you share with us a little bit about some of your thoughts about, because one of the things that we've realized as we've researched this topic is that Bill really intended for the 12 steps to help people achieve emotional sobriety. And I think, we can look at it so many different ways, but that emotional regulation, right? Being able to self-regulate ourselves and to manage our emotional experiences is such an important part of recovery. And I think that's what he was capturing, probably not understanding the full significance psychologically and maybe spiritually he got it, but boy, psychologically his insights were deep. But I'd love for you to share your thoughts about all of that.
So a metaphor, which I cannot claim totally originally as my own, but I think I tweaked it a little bit in my days of recovery, that really spoke to me about what emotional sobriety means or what it means to tend my emotions, is the metaphor of a fire in a hearth. If you imagine like an old school cabin where that fire in the fireplace or the hearth was needed to heat the cabin. If you let the fire completely go die or completely die, completely deaden, you're not going to have warmth to heat the cabin. Yet if the fire rages out of control, you may burn down the cabin. And so
beautiful.
Emotional sobriety means how am I letting myself have emotions? Because unfortunately, I think when a lot of people hear regulation or managing emotions, it's like, well, let me just cut myself off from them because emotions cause me problems. And that's a lot of what I have seen too, especially when people get sober and their main coping skill goes away, is let me just avoid that my emotions are there altogether. Yet, as I said, as part of the metaphor, if we don't have skills for, sometimes the word managing could be a little bit of an edge for me, but if we don't have the skills to work with our emotions, to navigate our emotions, to tend the fire, if you will, then yeah, we can cause serious destruction with them. So I think what long-term sobriety has been for me is learning how to tend the fire.
Well, you also just touch on something that I think is way too a common error we make, is because we're human and we've grown up in this Western culture where we do all this all or none polarized stuff all the time. Is the idea cutting off emotions is and I like your fire analogy for that reason. Cutting off emotions is just another end of the continuum and just as problematic as being completely out of control of your emotions. It's like this is part of our humanity. That's what I love about this emotional sobriety stuff. I've learned so much from Alan about it's about embracing who we are, our whole selves.
I credit the work of Robert Ackerman for really calling me out on that when I had about 12 years in recovery. Mm-hmm. I got to hear him speak at one of the conferences that we go to. And I was at this time in my life where, I had a good few years sober. As I mentioned, I was getting established in the field and my writing and all of this. Yet I was not fully out about my sexuality in public spaces. Mm-hmm. I was out to people who mattered, but I was navigating this whole, but my family, because my family is different than I am. Let's just say that. And I was at a talk with him and just ended up weeping in the lecture hall because he says, until you can embrace and accept and be at peace with every part of yourself, you can't hope to be a fully emotionally healthy person. And I knew he was right. And at that point, I was navigating a lot of this, but what's appropriate for me to share as a professional, as a public figure, and then the family piece as well. But I had such a turning point year in 2015 when that really came to me in the way it needed to, that if I'm hiding any part of myself. And I think there's obviously boundaries we navigate about what is healthiest for us to share when we are public figures and we are entitled to our privacy about things that are going on in our life. But that to me felt very different from hiding, which I was definitely doing, because that tends to denote that there's some layers of shame there. So through that shame, I think, is another key part of what makes for emotional sobriety.
What's unique about working with trauma in this context or recovering from it?
Well, let's start with my soapbox of how are we defining trauma? Because it's a big word that can get overused or misused these days. And I still, even knowing all of that, I still keep a very broad definition of trauma, which is trauma as any unhealed human wound. Trauma comes from the Greek word meaning wound. So on one hand, it's recognizing that we as people in recovery have all been wounded somewhere along the way, or we have wounded others, or likely both. So really doing wound care. And I think the steps can help with a lot of this. A lot of spiritual practices can help with a lot of this. Yet for some of us, the nature of our traumatic experiences were just a certain kind of wound that cut a little too deep or festered a little too long. And as I've written in my work, Trauma on the 12 Steps and some other things, that's where doing a fourth and fifth step can be challenging. And I always say with survivors of trauma, I'm not about letting people off the hook with doing a fourth and fifth step, because I think the fourth and fifth step, for instance, can be very valuable in helping us put things into proper perspective. But it can be virtually impossible to approach that work unless you have done some trauma-specific help first, or either concurrent with you doing those steps. Because one of the ways that certain forms of emotional trauma can really mess with a person's brain is just knocking everything out of perspective. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, we see that with most folks in recovery. But then I go back to the early thing I said, which is most folks in recovery have experienced some kind of trauma. It just different degrees of it.
I love one of the things you say, because one of the things I'm always saying to people, because I've made so many mistakes with it through the years, which is a wonderful way to learn, right?
Right.
It's and I always have plenty of material. But it's define your terms. You know, sometimes I think it's because I'm an English major, but otherwise I think that may just be an advantage, because so often I see people just in the day to day in my office communicating, and you know, thinking they're in conflict, and I'm going like, I don't think they actually disagree with each other.
Right.
if we go below and define the terms, and I think. I love that you put that on the front end. Let's get this clear from the beginning.
Well, I was also an English major in my undergrad, and I jokingly say in my work, I'm still much more of an English teacher and a performing artist when it comes to teaching this content than I am a scientist. And I just think looking at words and where we get the meaning behind words can be a powerful clinical intervention in and of themselves. So I did a whole TED talk back in 2015 on the trauma as wound metaphor. You could check it out. Mm-hmm. We look at, what is trauma? If we can see it as a wound, we then recognize that there are so many different kinds of wounds and yep. so many different kinds of wound treatments that might be needed. And so thank you for highlighting that, Tom, because I think terms and looking at language can be helpful.
Could you, tell us how you came to this work and kind of like what your entry point is on the curriculum, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, how I came to this work. Like a lot of us, I used alcohol to self-medicate. I think my recovery story is, I like to say this even when I speak in recovery context, it shows that my higher power knows what they're doing. Putting me where I need to be to encounter the help that I needed. As I was about 19 years old, I would say, when I fully crossed the line, when I got pickled, so to speak, into, there's something wrong here with the way that I consume alcohol and pills. And it didn't take very long, because I grew up in a very religious home with a father who condemned you to hell if you even smelled wine. So alcohol and drugs weren't really accessible to me without getting into serious trouble in high school, but I used other ways. I was an overachiever, workaholic. A lot of the character traits of me developing addiction were certainly there. And yeah, there was plenty of unhealed trauma, which led to dissociation and other symptoms. But when I then went to college and alcohol became introduced, and I found out about fun things I could do with other chemicals too, it got bad pretty quickly. And I share this in some of my work, that I lived in a low grade suicidal ideation from about the time I was 9 or 10. And once alcohol and drugs entered the picture, that just really escalated. So my recovery story admittedly started as a geographic cure. But I wrote a piece a few years ago where it's like, geographics may not be a bad thing if you realize you're taking yourself with you. And the move I made was to Europe, to Croatia and Bosnia, where my family was from, originally, ancestrally. And there was a war that happened in the early 90s that I followed very closely and was very concerned about my homeland. And when I graduated my undergrad with that English and history degree, I had no idea what I wanted to do when I grew up. I was in a very bad way with my mental health symptoms. I felt like either I wasn't aware of the help that was available to me other than the campus counseling center. And with respect to my parents, because I've done a lot of unpacking of the role they've played in my life, they didn't have the tools to help. You know, Dad's answer was just go back to church, and Mom's was, you're too smart for all this, you'll figure it out. And so really in this moment of desperation, I ran away to Europe, and I got there and just after Thanksgiving of 2000. And I started working for a Catholic parish that was a major pilgrimage site in the Catholic world, early 2001. And I taught English, and I did, let me tell you this, working for the church is not a way to get sober in and of itself, especially the Catholic Church, where drinking more approved. And to me, one of the insanities was when I left the United States, I knew the way I was using pills was problematic, but didn't connect the dots yet that alcohol was an issue. And you will quickly learn moving to Eastern Europe whether or not alcohol is a problem. for you, and that very much happened. But how I ended up finding recovery was through the woman I identify even in my books as my first sponsor, Janet L. She was an American social worker. She had no Croatian roots, but she had made aid trips there during the war. And so in her retirement, she was invited to stay near the Catholic parish where I was working to work with some fledgling treatment endeavors in the country. And she started a 12-step meeting in the area. The very first exposure I had to anything recovery was in the summer of 2001. I went to a meeting with her to translate. It was not a 12-step meeting. It was what would be similar to like a county council on alcoholism meeting in that part of Bosnia Herzegovina. And I'm not a professional translator, but I could work on it in a pinch. And Janet spoke no Croatian, and so took me to this meeting. And I found it very interesting. I found her very interesting. She's no longer with us. She died at the end of 2017. And she was the very essence of attraction rather than promotion. And she helped me understand why at 25 years sober, she still called herself a recovering alcoholic. And because she was also an Ohio girl, I connected with her very, very much. And just through a series of conversations, she really showed herself to me as someone I could trust. I remember she gave me my first big book in Croatian and said, here, it'll help you understand the words a little better. She knew what she was doing. And then a little later in the summer of 2001, when I had a really bad experience that started with a relationship I had no business being around, I knew I could talk to her. And I did. And I still remember it was August of 2001. We sat under a tree. And I relayed to her for about 3 hours my life in chemicals and my life with trauma. And she validated both. And I still remember the life-changing direction she gave me that day. She, first of all, helped to, and I know a lot of your listeners may or may not still jive with the disease model of addiction. For me, it was incredibly helpful when it was introduced to me, because my father, again, raised me with this idea that alcoholism was a sin manifestation. And even in our openly mocked the idea that it was a disease. And she helped explain to me that this is a medical issue that you can treat. And I found that very empowering. And she said to me, Jamie, after everything you've been through, and I won't trauma dump here on the podcast, but it was a lot. She said, after everything you've been through, it's no wonder you turned out alcoholic. What are you going to do about it now? That was the same. And I say that directive really, I know we throw this phrase around a lot, changed my life, but it did change my life, because she first validated my struggle, honored my struggle, made sure I wasn't mired in shame about it. But then it was into action. She always used to say, chapter 6 is called into action, not into thinking. It's like, what's the action we're going to take here? And I'm just very grateful. And so I've been continuously sober since July of 2002. And I owe this woman every ounce of gratitude, because her working 12 step is why I'm here.
And she passed away. May she rest in peace. Yeah.
She rest in peace. Yeah. End of 2017. And I just have to say, I'm a little emotional sitting, especially with you, Tom and Alan, you know, as I'll use the term elders, not old. Janet was one of those beloved elders. And this summer, this June, my longtime sponsor died. And he was 83, and he was just 42 years sober, and taught me so much about what it means to be authentic and sober. And so I just thank all of you for paving the way.
Yeah. Well, you're giving a wonderful example of something I was writing about the other day, which is that people die, but relationships don't. And man, that the what you're talking about with both of those people, your sponsor more recently, but your friend in 17, it's like so many people think they have to cut things off when somebody's gone. And I work with quite a lot of people in grief. And one of the things I'm saying is you got to keep talking. You know, I don't know if they're going to listen. I go, I don't know either, but it's like, you're not finished with this relationship. You need to keep, and it makes all the difference in the world. And those relationships are alive and well, clearly, as I hear you talk. Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you for highlighting.
We carry them with us. Yeah.
One of my favorite quotes, this is from the playwright Robert Anderson, that death ends a life, it does not end a relationship.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. That's, I love it, yeah.
And I think that applies to what we're talking about here with honoring our elders, but it can also apply to, there may be trauma work to do around some of the people who died and went before you, and to know that, yes. Yeah. That there's still healing and connection to do even after death.
You're probably familiar with one of the discussions that's going on right now about trauma that Gabor Mate has brought into focus in his writings. But a lot of my clients are starting to talk about this idea that trauma is perception.
It is.
And it is. But it's a slippery slope in one way, because it suggests that let's say a child who's traumatized has mm-hmm. a choice in their perception, mm-hmm. you know, and it's to me, it's I think it's very true. What you're saying is the model you have is just like you were told. Yeah, these things happen to you. Now, what are we going to do with it, right? I think that's very healthy mm-hmm. approach to dealing with these things. But I think that there's a little bit of a danger with that. You know, like, let's say, look at Piaget's model of cognitive development, right? Mm-hmm. From 2 to 7, these kids are pre-operational. They mm-hmm. can only focus on one element. Mm-hmm. So their trauma is a perception. They're growing up in a context that gives meaning to what that experience is. They don't have a lot of degrees of freedom. I mean, they don't.
Let me backtrack on something I said, because when you brought out trauma's perception, I'm like, it is. I think what's more accurate to say, and this is how I teach it for sure, is trauma is subjective.
Yes.
It's a subjective construct. And I tend to be a one-trick pony in the way I teach on trauma, because I go back to the trauma as wound metaphor. Right. And how I would explain that is wounds come in different shapes and sizes, for sure. And that can be part of why certain people feel more traumatized, quote unquote, than others. But if you think about physical wounds and how they heal, we have a lot of metaphorical richness there we can draw from. During the pandemic, if we weren't already familiar with the term immunocompromised, we became familiar with that term or what exposures can mean, that there are some people who, sometimes it's nature, sometimes it's nurture, can be a bit more immunocompromised emotionally. Mm-hmm. Even in DBT, Marsha Linehan's work, she would talk about the emotional sunburn that some people are more prone to getting than others. So I think there's a lot of factors that can go into why certain people experience trauma differently in one way than the other. We've heard this in recovery all the time. The story of, well, two kids grew up in the same house and one kid may say, oh, everything was fine. What do you mean? And another kid feels like they were really deeply wounded by what happened. So I'm interested in what was the subjective experience of the two different kids, even if they did experience similar wounding. So yeah, you can call that perception, perhaps, but I think it's more, let's look at the variables that are at play that got in the way of you healing or processing the wounds that you did experience.
The idea of understanding it as perception, I call it the mechanics. That's the mechanics of it. It doesn't carry with it a judgment. It doesn't carry with it, therefore you should be able to change that just now. It's like all that means is and like you say, Alan, it's, you know, and I love Bob Subbe, since we're quoting folks who we love, it's like Bob Subbe who wrote Lost in the Shuffle, you know, as children were victims, as adults were volunteers. You know, I mean, it's such a powerful thing that we're not trying to make kids responsible for that. But when we start to help heal and repair, that understanding of perception, that gives that as the people who are working with them, that helps us to know where we need to go.
Do you guys remember that teacher that had fallen in love with a 12-year-old student? It was a woman. I can't remember her name right now.
Oh, Mary Kay Letourneau.
Yes, she was imprisoned for 7 or 12 years, something like that, and they got married.
They did.
They got married. And recently he was interviewed, right? There's this one person I know who's working on his degree as a psychologist. And part of his dissertation was to interview victims of supposedly these, what we would call exploitive relationships, right? And he sat down with this now adult person, right? And spent a good couple hours interviewing him. And saying, well, how did you experience this? Did you feel like you were taken advantage of, that there was such an age difference and difference in power? He said, no. I did not perceive that as an issue for me. I fell in love with this woman, and this woman loved me. And she gave me something that no one else gave me in my life. And I am forever grateful for that relationship. And everybody else has a lot of problems with it. I'm not having those problems with it. It's meant the world to me. And he talks about her with such esteem. He holds her in such high regard. Now this person that was doing the interview and saying, now, was this just a defense to protect himself? Mm-hmm. Did he perceive this in that way to make it cognitively acceptable, right? Right. What we would call in psychoanalytic terms egosyntonic, right? You've probably heard that term before. You know, was that just a way of making it egosyntonic? I don't know.
And you bring up a point with that example, because just because he didn't perceive it as harm.
Was it harm?
Harmful because he was a child. Like, you know, I get a little squidgy around that.
And me so, too. I mean, it goes against everything in my body. Yeah. That's wrong. That's wrong. 12-year-old. Was she in her 30s? Do you know?
Yeah. How old was she? She was significantly older. She had her own children at that point. And I think that's the problem of looking at perception as the only thing that defines traumatic impact. Yeah. So.
No, that is. Because perception is so subjective, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, look. You and I can look at the same experience and we can have a very different, we can give very different meanings to it, just like, you know, what we're talking about here. You know, it was interesting that Irv Polster, who was one of the, I think, incredible, great voices of Gestalt therapy. I used to love going to the Evolution of Psychotherapy conferences to watch him do sessions, because masterful therapist. I mean, one of the best I've ever seen. And also was his wife, Marion Polster. She was every bit as brilliant, maybe even sharper than Irv was. But they were, what a duo. I mean, what a powerful pair when you put them on stage together. But you know what? He was talking about trauma as being an experience that overwhelms the organism's ability to integrate the experience in a meaningful way.
Something I will say, when I teach courses on trauma, MDR, I always have people as a first exercise write down what their working definition of trauma is.
Yeah.
And it could be something you've heard from a teacher, like Irv. It can be something you've just intuited yourself. And then what I usually tell people after they write down their definitions is hold on to them because they're probably not wrong.
Yeah.
In that what, how you define, perceive, experience trauma may be different than how I do it. But when it relates to working with clients, it's important to have a bunch of different definitions in our tool belts.
Yeah, that's right.
One client may really like Irv's definition. Another client may resonate with the trauma as wound idea. Another client may really be into what Gabor Mate is saying about it. And for me, it all can be valid if it's leading people towards that. And what are you going to do about it now?
Well, see, that's what I was bringing it up for. Is that, not that I share that with people, but for me, that model of how can I help someone have an experience with what happened, the wounding,
right,
helps them digest that experience and grow from it.
Yes.
Right. You know, you hear today that we're all focused on not just post-traumatic stress, but post-traumatic growth.
Yep.
How can I take this experience I had, just like we do with our alcoholism? How many people say it's turned into an incredible gift? Mm-hmm. This thing that was so destructive, that caused so much pain to myself and others that I loved and cared about, and that really, you know, that compromise, that I compromised my integrity, my values, and all these things, and now I find it to be an incredible gift that I can share with others and that's of value to me, right? And yes. So how do we take an experience? See, that's to me the interesting thing, is what does it take to have an experience with a wound that then becomes something that helps us become what we can be?
It's a great question. It's a big question, because I think how we heal from a wound or a series of wounds is also subjective. From person to person. When I teach the trauma as wound metaphor during any of my courses, I always bring up the example of a friend of mine, a professional colleague friend, who was born with one leg. She will never get her leg back. That's not what healing physically will look like for her. And I think a lot of us, that metaphor would apply emotionally as well. What she has been able to do, though, is learn how to adapt. And she does that because of prosthetic technology, her coping that she has in place, her spiritual frame of reference, all her various skills. So I think even in the presence of severe wounding that's happened in your life, maybe even wounding you were born with, you can learn how to adapt. But then here's the big, where we have to be sensitive, especially as clinical providers, not everybody is shown how to use the skills they need to adapt. Not right. Everybody has the resources to do amazing therapy and
get prostheses, right? Like you said that she got, you know, some.
Yeah. So there's this very insensitive statement in the English language that we have to learn to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. And I think we just have to be mindful that some people don't know how to do that. Some people don't have straps, let alone boots. And so in helping people who want to heal from their wounds or adapt from their wounds, I think at very first we have to look at, do they have what they need? Like I can, even with my trauma history, when Janet said, what are you going to do about it now? I was in a very privileged position, meaning that I had a strong work ethic.
Yeah.
I had a lot of emotional resources that I didn't fully lose in my addiction. And then when I did come back to the US and do graduate school, I figured out how to make it work. And I know there's a lot of people I've worked with who don't, either because of deeper mental health struggles or because of lack of financial resources, can't do it. So that's why I think we have to continue having bigger conversations about what are some systemic factors that are in play that can keep people from accessing the help they need. While also, like, it's that two things can be true at the same time, realizing that so much of what we do in recovery is an inside job. And I'm just very, very grateful that she gave me that challenge. What are you going to do about it now? I turned it in my head at a certain point into like, I'm not going to let the bastards win. And I don't know if that was the healthiest motivation to have or not, but it worked.
Well, that's what we're talking about. What works?
Yeah. Yeah.
It mobilized you into a place of being able to tap into your strength.
Right. And I will, I'll make a direct recovery meeting story to when that really clicked for me. I was about 8 months sober, sitting in a meeting. And that's when the acceptance passage struck me like a bolt of lightning. Because so much of my life to that point, at 23, 24, I had lived with this sense of when they understand, then I will be better. Mm. When my father finally apologizes, when my mother finally gets it, when the boyfriend.
Conditional. Once this. Yeah.
Once all of that happens, then I will be okay. And hearing the passage, it was this sense of, wow, they may never do any of those things. And I have to proceed as if they're not going to. And I actually found that a very empowering moment. It's on me.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously with the help of my higher power and support and all of this, but it took away that, and that's a gift that I got early on that has really helped me through all of these years, is realizing I can't rely on that conditional stuff that, well, when this happens, then it'll fall into place.
I love Alan's antidote. What I think of as his antidote to that is I'm okay even if.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm okay. You know, if this doesn't happen, it's such a foreign turn to get to, and I've been focusing on this more recently over the last few years, is like through emotional sobriety, is recovering from that conditional thinking now we're talking about something that is basic to emotional sobriety, in my opinion.
Right.
And it's deep in us. I mean, there's not one of us is not going to experience thoughts today that are based in that. Now, we may be faster to respond to them and move ourselves beyond them, but it's like the reflexes don't change.
Yeah.
You know, we're still going to have those. And it's like, so I love that when you say, Alan, you say that on Thursday nights a lot, which is, I'll be okay even if this does happen or doesn't happen. It's like,
I want to share with you guys a client that's come to mind as we're talking. And it's one of these, I think when I share with you what happened to him, you'll understand and then understand some of the work that needed to take place. So I'm working at San Pedro Peninsula Hospital, right, which was a 30-day program back in the 70s, right, when insurance paid for 30 days. And then we were a unique program in that we had a 9-month outpatient program that
involved
the whole family for 9 months, including the kids, Jamie. I mean, we were doing that work before Claudia Black, you know, even was thinking about it. I mean, it was pretty phenomenal stuff. And so this young Latino man comes into the program and he's in a wheelchair. And he lost both of his legs in Vietnam.
Hmm.
Both of his legs. And what happened in Vietnam was that he was in one of those observational posts. So like I was on Hill 55. And so we had these OPs out way in front of the wire that would alert us if there was going to be an attack so that the whole base could mobilize and, you know, do all the things would try to do to protect ourselves from being overrun. So he was out in one of these OPs and they were under heavy attack. And one of the Viet Cong snuck up on their bunker and threw in a satchel charge.
Wow.
He saw the thing hit the bunker and he took his friend. It was he and his friend in there. And he pushed his friend out and then he started to leap out. But he only got halfway out.
Mm-hmm.
And when the satchel charge went off, it severed both legs. Right below the hips. Right. Essentially. I mean, no legs. So that was this fellow that he saved went back and had another tour of duty in Vietnam and was killed in that second tour of duty.
Wow.
So he's dealing with the loss of his legs, which in any context would be tough. Right. But now what meaning did that have? I saved his life for what purpose? So I'm sitting here now with no legs and I saved the life of someone who went back and put himself in harm's way again. And the loss of my limbs are meaningless to me. What a tough, and, you know, talk about severe alcoholism. My God, he was, I mean, the minute he opened his eyes, he was drinking until he went to bed at night. And when he came into treatment, he had one of these wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. It was like he had armored this thing. So there was weapons hidden in pipes. I mean, he was rock and ready to rock and roll in a minute because he was still living in Vietnam. He had never left Vietnam, right? Never left Vietnam. He was still over there. And talk about that deep wound. It's so many levels, right? First of all, adapting to now spending the rest of your life in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And what that means, right? As a dad, as a man, as a, you know, and he, you know, had a great job at an aerospace company. He worked on the space shuttle, you know, and was an engineer and was great, very bright, bright man, but could not find a way to deal with that wound. Yeah. You know, we did a lot of work. I mean, I saw him for a long time, and he died sober. I mean, that's the good thing, is that he was able to get his recovery. I don't know if he got to the point in dealing with that, that he saw it as a blessing. Do you know what I mean? I'm not so sure that he ever made that transition into, I'm grateful I lost my legs. I don't think that he did, as I recall. But what he did do is what you said, Jamie, and that's why it kind of came to mind. He accepted that this, I made that choice because it was the right choice at the time. I didn't know he was going to die.
Right.
And I did that because that's who I am as a man and as a fellow Marine, is we look out for each other. I get touched when I say that.
Yeah.
And when he got that, when he realized that he made that decision for the right reason, it turned out to be incredibly tragic, right? But he looked back. That was the one thing he could hang his hat on. He was proud of the man he was, and that he would do that. And he said, you know, for so many years, I would judge myself, and I say, if I knew what happened, would I have saved him? And he said, you know what I've come to in my recovery? I would have. Because it was the right thing to do at the time.
Right.
And that helped salvage something in him. I don't, you know, it didn't bring his legs back, of course, right? They're not, like you said, they're not going to come back. But yeah. You know what it did? It salvaged a piece of himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
That he lost in the trauma. And that's one way I think of trauma sometimes, is we lose a piece of ourselves in that trauma.
Of course. Of course.
That's the wounding part that makes it so tough psychologically.
And something I connected to years ago is that all trauma work involves grief work, because any traumatic experience, we lose something, whether it is our legs and our sense of meaning, our sense of
zeal. We lost our zeal, our passion for life, our excitement, our interest. I mean, it got muted.
Yeah. For me, it was a lot of grieving the childhood I needed to have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That was never going to happen. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You were going to be okay, even if. Yeah.
And going back to two things could be true at the same time. Yes, I did that grief work and I had a lot of tears. And I also practiced that acceptance, which I learned in recovery, that I can't change what happened in my past. I can't change the situation into which I was born. And I find that acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. So empowering. It's tricky for a lot of people with where they're at in trauma recovery, because it can feel like acceptance means you're saying you're glad it happened, or you're saying, no, acceptance does not mean resignation.
It means you acknowledge you can't change it.
Yeah. You stop fighting the reality that it happened.
That's it. Yeah.
Or, you, a certain
we've been calling it being offended by reality. You need to stop being offended by reality. And it's like, and if you don't think you are, just pay attention to one day you're thinking. It's right. I can get offended at the rain. You know, it's like, you know, how dare it be raining on me now? But what you're saying is so, I mean, there is no resolution to grief without acceptance, right?
Right.
Let me chew with that one a little bit, because I think acceptance can come in different levels when you're grieving. But fundamentally, acceptance, how we're defining it in recovery, being the answer to all my problems today. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I'm thinking as I'm listening to you, Jamie and Alan, your example is something that I've experienced as I've gotten older and done this longer. It's like, I follow if I'm following my client, which is what I've always been taught, or I always taught best to go with my client rather than me try to lead them. It's right. Like, if I follow my client, very often when we're talking about issues like this that are this deep and this important, you know, I'm following them right out of psychology into philosophy. It's like we're, because now we're talking about meaning. Your story there, Alan, was a perfect example of that. It's like a man who can find meaning in just something that most people probably couldn't.
One of the ways of getting to acceptance that one of the things that I think was an incredible insight that Fritz had, one of the co-founder of Gestalt Therapy, is you get to acceptance by having non-acceptance.
Let's go there. Yeah. Let's hear more about
it. Well, it's a paradoxical thing. See, you know, like, and I've seen it myself, is when I rage, I will never accept this. I won't accept it. I can't, it shouldn't be this way. And I rage. If I do that, and I really do that completely, what happens at the end of it? It's a spontaneous connection to acceptance.
Yeah. Ooh.
You know, it's not, see, I can't will the acceptance. I can't say, I'm going to accept this when I'm not, right? It's like, I've got to say, I'm not going to accept this. I'll never accept it. And if I yell about that long enough, all of a sudden I start breaking down in tears, like you said, Jamie. Mm-hmm. And in that grief, in that crying about it, is the tears are part of the acceptance.
Yeah.
It's a part of the melting away of all of the other stuff that's going on that makes it so hard to accept. And I saw that with that young man. I mean, I'll tell you, some of the sessions we had, I mean, it really brought me back to a lot of my post-traumatic stress, you know, at the same time, because that's what this does, right? I mean, that's why it's so important that those of us that are working with people deal with our own trauma as well. Well, this has been great having you on the show.
It's been lovely. I feel like I started my day with a great meeting. This is.
Thank you for coming and joining us. Absolutely. Let's do it again.
I always take that as a compliment.